All right, welcome back to the show, and thank you guys for joining us. And I'm excited to be joined by our guest today. I teased this on last week's show, and got a fascinating guest here. Bit of a finance renaissance man. Done a little bit of everything, and also the author of the number one New York Times bestseller, Colossal Failure of Common Sense. About the failure of Lehman, and told in first person, which is so much different than all these other memoirs that we've read about the collapse. And of course, I'm speaking about the great Lawrence McDonald. Larry, thank you. Do you prefer to be referred to as Larry or Lawrence? Is it Larry?
Yeah, Larry's fine. Thank you, Zach.
Okay, good. I didn't want to be talking out of school there. But anyway, Larry, thank you so much for joining us, and I've really been looking forward to this. First of all, loved your book. We're in 12 different languages. Do I have that right now?
We are in 12 different languages. You know, I tell my, as a former Lehman trader, I tell my wife once a month, if we sell a million books, we'll break even on our Lehman stock.
The numbers are what, 650,000 now copies of the book that have sold?
Yeah, we're about 650 now.
Yeah, I mean, that's no small dig. So it tells you, you know, it tells you what a hole was left on your personal balance sheet from Lehman. Before we get into that, because I am, like I said, I can't recommend the book enough. I thought you did a great, just a really interesting job of, you know, explaining it, but also your life story and how you integrated that into everything. I just, fascinating read. I couldn't recommend it enough. But I also wanted to start off with something that I identified with you right out of the gate, was your start. You were not a blue blood son of a hedge fund trader. Your dad was a very accomplished guy, but you weren't ushered into the best schools with the Ivy on the fences out front and a straight shot into the Ivy League. You went through, I think you used, in your words, you said you didn't go through the back door. You actually went through the back window. Give me a little bit. Start us off. You know, you were trying to break into the industry, get into the securities business, and you were nobody wanted to hire you. And you started off selling meat. Do I have that correct?
Yeah. Well, as Doyle Bronson, the famous poker player, always said, he said, when luck shuts the door, you have to come in through the window. And absolutely, my mom and dad got divorced when I was about 10. And for about 8 years, I was in 8 different schools. We went from the apple orchards of Bolton, Massachusetts, you know, beautiful, 10,000 square foot home to, housing project pretty quick. And my brothers and I and my sister, big family, we had a number of tough years in Worcester, which is a really tough city. And but at the end, I think it made me a better person, made me respect the value of a dollar and got me grounded. But when I eventually came out of school, we had the Gulf War was upon us, and we also had the SNL crisis. So those things were pretty fascinating. You have to remember there were hundreds and hundreds of savings and loans that went out of business in the United States and early 90s. And so I tried to get a job. I think I had 100 rejection letters from all the different Wall Street banks, firms, and multiple times at each one. And finally, I made my way down to, I struck out in Boston, struck out in New York, and went down and tried Philadelphia. And I snuck into the building of this Merrill Lynch office, and I snuck in. I dressed up as a pizza delivery man. And I had my suit underneath, and I went into the bathroom. I was taking off the white overcoat, and I was caught by a couple of the producers, and they brought me into the office, and they sat me down on the chair, and they said, "What the heck are you doing?" And I just told them, I said, "Listen, I want to work with you guys, and I've got a burning desire to get into this business and achieve big things." And they said, "Well, You know, on the retail side of the business, Larry, the key to that is really sales and perseverance. So you have to go out and sell something. And then one of the guys on the desk just said, yeah, go out and sell pork chops. So it was kind of a dare, and I went out and for, you know, 3 or 4 months, sold pork chops, came back, and they gave me a job.
And then you became a, these are my words, of course, but a pork chop salesman extraordinaire. I mean, you were number one in the area. You went after that with the same abandon. You went after everything else, and you achieved a pretty astounding level of success doing that, didn't you?
Yeah, it was just, you know, New England back then was an interesting place to develop a business, and I used a lot of those contacts to develop the retail business. So went from, you know, all the way from Philadelphia through New England back up Philadelphia all the way up to New England back. So it was an interesting time.
And so then you finally you parlayed that into getting into, and I don't want to say it for you, but and for those of you that haven't read the book, we're doing a very high level overview here. So the actual stories themselves are, you know, I feel like I'm not even doing it justice. So I would encourage you, you know, to absolutely go read the book. But so then you finally break in. One of these sleuth pizza delivery deals works out for you. You finally turn some heads. You break in. You start selling convert bonds to the rich guys at the country club. And you started hitting your stride. And this was all about, correct me if I'm wrong, all around age 25, 26, correct?
Yeah, 25, 26. And I started to develop an attraction to the convertible bond market, because what was fascinating about convertible bonds is a convertible bond is part equity, right? So it's right. Part stock and it's part fixed income. So I figured, okay, I can learn two crafts at the same time. And it's also has an equity option component. So you can learn a little bit about pricing volatility. So I found that pretty fascinating. And in the mid 90s, a good friend and I, Steve Seafeld, started a website called convertbond.com. So I left the retail side of the business. I thought the retail brokerage business would be consumed, and really, I thought it was in a tough spot up against the Schwabs and the potential of online trading coming down the pike with the internet upon us. So we decided to create a website that focused on convertible bonds. And I look back and, you know, we probably should have just created a dating website, you know, but we had a good time with convertbond.com, and we ended up selling it to Morgan Stanley in October of 99, you know, 3 months before the top. So that was a very, very fortunate sale.
Boy, I would say so. The other thing, and this is kind of taking a side path here. The other thing I found interesting about these stories was, now this might be a loose connection to some, but I was fascinated at how you guys spotted the capability or the potential of the internet and integrating it into the business. Like you said, you saw the trouble that was going to, or the shakeup, if you will, that was going to create in the industry. And then when I read the story about how you guys put Convert Bond together, reading the story from you, it just seems so obvious. And yet, like so many other things, and I don't want to give it away, but we would see this play out again during the Lehman crisis. Like so many other things, these changes or these turning points in economies and markets, they seem to not get noticed by the insiders, that it's those people like yourself that didn't follow the traditional path that tend to see these turning points, like the effect the internet would have in the securities business, like the, you know, all the issues you saw going on in the real estate business. Why is it, Larry, from your perspective, from a guy that I think that your background is so unique, there's just not many guys that have hustled on the retail brokerage side of things and then been the head traders of trading desks inside Wall Street. Why is it that the outsiders seem to be the ones that pick up on these massive titanic turning points in economies? And while the people inside of it that came up the traditional route tend to be, I don't know if it's oblivious or I don't know if it's uncaring or reckless. Maybe it's a combination of all that. How do you describe that? Like I said, you got these two turning points where you guys saw the economic opportunity. Then you also spotted the real estate part of it, both of which the market, interestingly enough, right, the powers that be and the big players in the market, they miss both of them. Why are the outsiders typically the ones that spot these things?
Well, the biggest reason of all is they're not bought into, you know, the buy-in when you're vertically integrated. Like Lehman was vertically integrated into mortgages. So what that means is when a company is vertically integrated, they not only originate the mortgages and sell them and move them on, but they own the mortgage company that originates them. And so they have multiple risks. And when you originate the mortgage and you own the mortgage company, and then you have a Wall Street bank that sells the mortgages to other people around the world, it's very easy to get so bought in that you ignore the risks. You know, that's because the business became, you know, such a big part of the profits. And you know, I always say, you know, I always look back to what Steve Jobs, you know, maybe 15 years ago, was at a conference in the West Coast in the Valley, and he was quoting Einstein, and he said to the audience, he said, you know, talent hits a target no one else can hit. Genius hits a target no one else can see. And it's not really about genius. It's more about really working hard at looking for that risk. And whereas if you really work at it day in, day out, and you're not overly bought in and with the blinders on, right? So the buy-in, yep, creates blinders. Those that combination allows you to find some genius.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and the name of the show is Know Your Risk Radio. We're constantly preaching that message that, look, the positive outcomes will take care of themselves. What, you know, you can't be doomsdayers and lock yourself up in a bunker, of course. But, you know, our job as allocators of capital is really to focus on the risk and see the opportunity, but really, you know, really identify that hidden risk. And I just thought that was fascinating that here in your story, we had this perfect setup of where that viewpoint allowed you to see opportunity and where it also allowed you to see risk. And both things, you know, sandwiched in together in a decade, just 10 years, were greatly overlooked by the industry at large. And I found that fascinating. So anyway, moving it along. Go ahead.
Well, just want to say my favorite quote ever, and it's such a moving quote for me. And it comes back to J.P. Morgan in 1907. J.P. Morgan 1907 states, "There's nothing in this world which will so violently distort a man's judgment more than the sight of his neighbor getting rich." You know, the neighbor getting rich. And, you know, that says it all, because it's when you're in a cycle that is booming, it's very easy for the plumber or the electrician, you know, sees the brother-in-law making a fortune in real estate, flipping homes, and all of a sudden you had people all around the country leaving, you know, 10, 20, 30-year careers to go jump into, you know, the real estate game. And that's literally the sight of the neighbor getting rich distorting a man's judgment.
Yeah, fascinating stuff. That's, you know, that was one of the ways we identified it. When you look around and you see everybody making money the same way and talking about how great it is, you kind of, that alone should cause some pause, right? We should take a step back at that moment and just say, wait a second, is it this easy? Because it probably shouldn't be. So, okay, so anyway, so moving on. And by the way, for those of you that have just joined us, we're with Larry McDonald, author of A Colossal Failure, A Common Sense, number one New York Times bestseller, and proprietor of the Bear Traps Report, who we are actually becoming a client of. He put out some amazing research. And so for those of you, they can find you at Lawrence, isn't it at Lawrence McDonald on Twitter? Did I get that right?
Well, it's at Convert Bond.
Okay, at Convert Bond. Yes, yeah, sorry. Yes. Yeah.
At Convert. But you can find it with the name too. The name works.
Okay, and a great follow. Okay, so now we're moving forward. We've got the start. You guys have got Convert Bond going. How did you, because I also really identified with your story of saying, hey, I'm going to do whatever I can to get here. But being a million-dollar producer in the retail channel was not the ultimate aspiration. It was to play in the big show. It was be down on the trading floors at the big exchanges. So how do we make that jump from a young guy, 26 years old, who's killing it on the retail side of it, starts Convert Bond, and then how did you break in? Where was that moment where you broke into the big game?
Well, my good friend from my hometown, I had a number of friends on Wall Street. So the first thing I did was I looked at, so I was at Morgan Stanley. I was running their convertible research effort or desk that called convertbond.com. So we were already on the institutional side. We were covering institutional accounts, but I wanted to work into trading. And I looked around through my entire Rolodex of friends all around the world that were in finance. And I had one friend that was at Lehman named Larry McCarthy. Larry McCarthy, Larry McDonald. But just, no,
it works.
two Irish friends from the hometown. And I pitched him on coming over there and starting a convertible trading business, convertible bonds, where we would work with their equity and fixed income divisions. And I did four or five interviews and got the job.
Okay. So now you're a trader. Now you've made it to the big game. You're trading at Lehman. And again, guys, we're just giving you the cliff notes. You gotta read the book for yourself. But let's jump forward to when we start seeing some things. What is the first thing? As your career progressed, what was the first thing? And I don't know if you recall that very first moment, but where you looked around and said, "Hey guys, we might have an issue here as far as the real estate mortgage subprime issue." Where was that first realization, and how did you come to that?
Well, I'll never forget. We're on the trading floor in 2007, and Larry used to have a famous line about leverage companies. Think about a leverage company. They have lots of debt and very little equity. And Larry kind of yelled across the desk, "That's big hat, no cattle." and then we started looking at the Lehman balance sheet, and Lehman was 44 times leveraged, 44 times. So that's like walking into a casino with $100 in your pocket, but you're playing at the table with $4,400, and
good while you're winning.
And so we were looking at this. I'm like, because when I joined the firm, Lehman was only like 25 times leveraged. Then 3 years later, we're like 44 times leveraged. And then one of the analysts that we had, Pete Hammack, brilliant analyst, did the math, and he told us all. He said AIG and Fannie Mae are 60 times leveraged. Jeez. And We had a discussion one day on the floor, like, what's really going on? And it was essentially, the banks had these huge deposits, Citigroup and J.P. Morgan. So when an investment bank has to compete with a large institution, leverage is important, number one, because you're competing against all those deposits. And then the other thing that we started to realize is that the death of the partnership was extremely important to the crisis, where years ago, through the last 100 years, a lot of these banks, insurance companies always had partners that owned all the equity. But when a company goes public and all the partners can sell their shares to the public, that's really the death of the partnership. So if Lehman had, or say any firm, has a number of key partners that own all the equity, they're going to keep a much closer eye on the risk. Whereas when the equity of a firm is diversified across thousands of investors, and then you bring in rating agencies and the like, it's very easy for people to take their eyes off the risk.
Yeah, well, and that's certainly, obviously, with hindsight, that's exactly what was going on. And then you wrote about this, too. I found it fascinating because I feel like it's, guys like you and I talk about it. I feel like it's largely an esoteric topic to most of the public. But I was fascinated by your work with Glass-Steagall, and Glass-Steagall was kind of a hobby or a just an interest of mine in general, because I wrote a term paper at the end of my college career about WorldCom for my one of my final papers for my finance degree. And I went into that whole research process, and I promise this is going to marry up. I went into the whole research process, digging into the WorldCom side of things, seeing where the fraud took place, and I kept ending inadvertently back to Glass-Steagall. And this was, you know, this is 2002, so significantly before the real estate collapse. And the term paper took a strange turn where it ended up being a focus on Glass-Steagall and how I didn't think the WorldCom thing, at least at the scale it grew to, was possible outside of Glass-Steagall. And then watching that come to the fore again in the 08-09 financial crisis, and then watching nothing happen to it on a legislative basis afterwards, it wasn't corrected. From your perspective, how much did the dissolution of Glass-Steagall play into all of this?
Oh, it had a ton. It had a ton to do, because when it wasn't just Bill Clinton, but it was Bill Clinton and the Republicans,
right?
They dismantled Glass-Steagall with the Graham-Leach-Bliley Act, and it allowed the investment banks to compete, you know, with the big banks. So you've got a bank like Lehman that's really small, no deposits, and all of a sudden you're competing against a bank with $2 trillion in deposits, right? So that just forces the investment bank to take lots of risks. And there was really, it wasn't an even playing field. And I'm very confident that if Glass-Steagall wasn't dismantled, that the financial crisis would not have been anywhere near as severe as it was.
Well, and doesn't that play right in, and feel free to shut me down, but the way I've looked at it is, we were speaking earlier about the vertical integration. Had those things been separate, they would have been looked at with a much more jaundiced eye, right? They wouldn't have, at least from my perspective, you would have had, you know, just in the packaging of one of these mortgage bonds, you would have had two or three different risk offices assessing this as opposed to one, right? You wouldn't have had this inbred nature to it. And then one of the things that I posited or I came to was, just that alone, kind of the dissolution of those firewalls that were previously in place, just due to the fact that you couldn't be vertically integrated to that level. Don't you think that did that play into it as well? I mean, just kind of moving one hand, you know, moving money from one pocket to the other, meaning that, you know, this stuff didn't have to go through multiple compliance offices. It was just one. And these companies were allowed to, through Glass-Steagall, to become vertically integrated, in your words?
Yeah, and it was the regulators, because of the Glass-Steagall and because of the vertical integration, you went from one regulator that was looking at, say, the banks or the SNLs, to all of a sudden there were five regulators that were responsible for Lehman. So what happens when you have five regulators, responsibility goes out the window. So you had the New York Fed, you had the FDIC, the SEC, FINRA. So you had so many different regulators. And when you have that many, it's very clear that nobody is really accountable and nobody really takes authority.
Yeah, yeah. So we've got this situation where you guys start seeing, this all hat, no cattle scenario playing out. And the other part that I found fascinating was the visit that you guys made and the conversations you had with the folks at New Century. Was that in the book that served as kind of a way marker? Was that the point where you guys said, okay, this thing's going down, we need to play it from the short side? This is definitely the way that this thing's going to unfold. Was that the eureka moment, if you will, or did it come earlier?
Well, we with our research team, we look for what we call, you know, systemic risk indicators. We had a basket of risk indicators that were starting to rise, And the one thing that we started watching were early payment defaults. So let's just say early payment default is when someone misses their first mortgage payment. And we're not talking about a default on a mortgage. We're talking about buying a home and then counting around the country how many people are missing the first mortgage payment, the first one. And what we calculated in like 2006, in the whole country, there were less than 20 of them. But by 2007, that number had gone up to close to 2,000. In each quarter, that number was going up exponentially. So it was about creating a basket of indicators that would give you kind of an early warning sign. That really helped us a lot. And that's what we're doing today.
Okay. Okay. So yeah, same process then. And then you guys, the other thing that I, there was a lot fascinating, but the other thing that I found interesting is you guys tried to take this to supervisors. You guys started taking that eye of what you saw, that basket of indicators, and you started looking at Lehman's scenario and going, wait a second. We're not observing this from the outside. We're actually a part of it. And you started trying to make the supervisors, the guys that, you know, the risk managers aware of that. What was that process like? And was that insanely frustrating for you guys that those warnings weren't heeded?
Well, yeah. So Madeline Antonczyk, our risk manager, who we were educating Madeline Antonczyk on a regular basis and just showing her some of our data, and she was very helpful. So she took some of our data into the meetings, and then she was actually thrown out of a meeting by our CEO. And so it's got to the point where what happens on Wall Street when the executives, when the CEO has, you know, tons of control over a board, the risk management people just become, you know, it's just unbelievable. They become almost like bureaucrats that are just not respected, and that's what was happening with Lehman.
Well, and you had a somewhat of a tyrant at the top there with Dick Fuld, and I you know, just from your stories about it, and then anecdotal stories from my time in the industry, he wasn't the most open-minded fella when it came to identifying these risks and taking heed. And I just, one of the interesting things that I'd never really thought about reading your book was Lehman really didn't get caught unaware. There were plenty of people inside the company that saw the issue. He just didn't want to listen to it. Like you said, it just, everybody became, you know, I guess subjects of Dick Fuld and where he wanted to take things. And that was just sort of the end of the story. Was when did you guys know that about him at that time? Because I just, not to beat around the bush, I was surprised through going through the read at how much of this you laid at his feet and the executives running the company. I was expecting to read more of a systemic failure type thing, where it really was, from your perspective, you know, much more of a focused screw up, if you will, or a blind spot. Were you one and only in the firm? I mean, was there a very select few of you that had that impression, or were many of you concerned about the blindness or the, I guess, the willful blindness of Dick Fuld and some of the upper management around him?
Well, the words I always live by is, you know, there's no I in team ever.
Right.
And I was part of a wonderful group of people. So there was Mike Gelban now was the number two man at Millennium. He just founded a $8 billion hedge fund, Exodus Point. Mike was a very, very brilliant risk manager and clearly saw the warnings. And Mike helped us. We, as a group, you know, there's no I in team, but in 2007, we made close to $2 billion on the short side betting against some of these, like you said, the New Centuries and some of these companies in the mortgage space. And but for every dollar we were making, they were losing about eight upstairs.
Wow. Wow. And that again was another part of the story that really shocked me, because I sat there and I went, it's just unbelievable that you've got a trade desk that so clearly identified the issue that they were making billions of dollars in profit on it, while they were literally profiting off the poison that was slowly killing the firm. Slowly at first, then quick picked up the pace. So, okay, now from the inside out, because again, our my experience and everybody else is watching this unfold from the outside. When was that moment in time where you guys at the Lehman trading desk went, oh no, it has started and this is headed in the wrong direction? I know you guys saw the seeds of it. We've already talked about, but where was that moment where you said, okay, the game is on. This thing is happening now.
When New Century in February 2007, and New Century equity went from $32 to zero in like 30 days.
Yep.
And remember, New Century was a mortgage originator. And so we had gone out about the month before that. We were short New Century. We'd gone out to the West Coast. And the big short movie kind of stole our scene. But there's a scene in the book where we go out to the West Coast, and we went to this kind of lounge bar near New Century where their offices were, and we saw this the Corvettes, the Lamborghinis, the Porsches outside. And we go in there and we start talking to some of the salespeople on a Friday. It might have been a Thursday, Friday, you know, around 4 o'clock or 5 o'clock. Everybody's getting out of work. And, yeah, I just couldn't believe what I was hearing from some of these people. They were selling these, you know, they weren't the brightest bulbs on the planet. They were making millions of dollars a year. And they were selling, you know, adjustable rate reset mortgages to people that, you know, kind of loans that would actually, they knew would blow up on their clients, you know. So these are really bad people. And these products are massively unsustainable. And this was New Century's, you know, kind of sales force. And then we came back to New York, and sure enough, a month later, we put on a bunch of shorts and put spreads on New Century. And a month later, the company imploded. And that was really the moment we knew that this is a real problem.
One of the things that cracked me up is you guys were structuring those put options and those shorts, and you were sitting there saying, hey, if this thing drops to 20, we're going to make a pile. Little did you guys know that you weren't going to have to. 20 was not going to be the threshold of profit for that trade. That thing was going to zero in a hurry. I got a chuckle out of that because, you know, from the inside out, again, we're risk managers. You're setting up a trade and you're sitting there going, okay, where is the point where this thing's going to be profitable? When you guys were putting that on, again, the structuring of the trade, I know you don't think like that. Did you think it was a zero, or did you just think it was going to get hammered hard? What was the viewpoint of that? Were you guys thinking, okay, this thing is going to nothing, or is it just it's going to get hammered hard?
Well, our analyst, Christine Daly, who's like one of the best distress analysts, you know, she was looking at the company wasn't quite distressed yet, but she was looking at the assets, she was looking at the balance sheet. She thought it was a zero, but you know, we all thought it would take a good year. What we didn't imagine is that it would take that short period of time. And what people have to understand, and for investors listening to us right now, the one thing to always remember is when you look at a stock or, you know, any stock, you have to look at the whole capital structure. So there's debt and equity. And with some companies, say like Apple, Apple's equity is 90% equity. I'm sorry, Apple's enterprise value. So the value of the whole company for Apple is 90% equity and like 10% debt.
Right.
But most people just look at the equity, right? And so this, there are companies out there like Tesla that are, you know, that are, or Deutsche Bank or some of these leveraged banks where right. you can have a company that's 50, 60, 70% debt and maybe 30, 40, 50% equity. And in the case of New Century, the public equity might've been $30 a share, but the company had tons and tons of debt and off balance sheet leverage. So Christine just felt if there was a problem, the equity would get wiped out really fast because, let's just say in this case, the equity might be $30, maybe that's $2 billion, but they had, you know, close to $20 billion of debt and obligations. So net, 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 you really, even though the stock's $30, you think you own a stock, but you just own a little tiny sliver of equity in a pie. And when you have that type of just a sliver of equity in a pie, that's where the stock can go to zero really, really fast.
Yeah, you've got that upside down equity or that upside down capital structure. And you know, that's funny because I listened to that today. I think you can be too far inside sometimes and you know, too, I don't know, two, well, the old adage, you know, if you're standing 4 inches away from an elephant, try to describe it. You know, you got to step back to get some, you know, view and some scale. But you don't hear people talk about enterprise valuation enough anymore, right? Taking that debt into consideration and looking at that capital structure. And it kind of surprises me because I feel like we're here again, only another 9 or 10 years later. I hear that same mistake being made. And I don't want to make this transition too quick because I want to ask you a couple things. Do you see some similarities with where we're currently at in relation to what you experienced in 08-09?
Yes, but not from the banks, more from the corporations. So
right.
What's happening now is, you know, elections have a lot to do with business cycles. And what we're going to see the next couple of years is the White House is going to do whatever they possibly can to extend this business cycle. You know, they're getting help from the Fed. The Fed promised us 3 rate hikes this year in October. And then by, you know, early January, the market's starting to look at 2 rate cuts in terms of probability. So that's a reversal of 5. You know what I mean? We were going to go from 3 rate hikes to now, as of this, you know, say as of the first quarter, the market's looking for 2 cuts. So that's huge. Colossal move in central bank policy, and that plus some fiscal stimulus. If the White House has a number of plans that I think they're in the works from whether Fannie and Freddie to expand the credit box there. So what happens is that you have a business cycle that's gone on for a long time. You have an election, and they will do whatever they can to extend this cycle. And what'll happen is the debt profile of on the corporate bond side is already right now really, really, really ugly in terms of leverage. And it's only going to get more leverage the next, you know, 6-9 months. And then we're going to have a big collapse sometime in the next, you know, 12 to 18 months. But they're going to do whatever they can to keep it right after the election.
Yeah. And one of the things that I want to talk to you. So, you know what, I won't try to hold this back because this is really what I've been interested in. Well, I think the whole thing is interesting, but the point I wanted to get to was to ask you where we're at now. So how, and I know we're all stabbing in the dark here, but the ability for central banks to keep juicing this thing and keep things on the rails has really astounded me. I really thought that they would lose control at some point. How much longer do you think that they can extend this process? And what do you think will be the break point? You know, and again, I understand we're all speculating at this point, but where is that point where the transmission of all this central bank policy breaks down and the weight on the other side of the scale becomes too great for the Fed to keep propping things up?
Well, it's going to be similar to remember the early payment default with the mortgages, right?
Yep.
So they lent so much money to so many poor borrowers that they, in other words, the lending was so disgusting and so prevalent, the excessive lending, that they were lending to people that couldn't make the first mortgage payment, right?
Right.
So the same thing now is happening with countries, okay, so sovereign countries, you know, as well as corporations. So what we're going to start to see sometime in the next, you know, 12 months, most likely, is a point where corporations start missing their first coupon payment on a bond. So you'll have a multi-billion dollar issue bond. Everybody wants to buy it because the Fed's on hold and, you know, the White House is doing whatever they can to juice the economy. And you want to watch, instead of that early payment default on mortgages, you want to watch corporate bonds and sovereign bonds missing those early coupon payments.
Yeah, so that's that ignition point that you guys are looking for. Yeah, and I echo that. I think of Tesla. You brought Tesla up, and we just had a bond repayment, and I don't think that they're going to be able to raise capital through selling equity, so my guess is they're going to try to access the bond markets again. And I'm no credit expert, but you know that you think about Tesla, and I think about a scenario where you could easily see a company like that take out a big bond payment, or you know, do a big money raise, a debt raise, and miss that first interest payment. That'll be fascinating to keep an eye on. So between now and then, over the progression of this, what do you think the road to that is, and do you think there's any way? How do you think that they're going to try to combat that? Because the one thing that I've come to the realization of, probably too late, only a couple years ago, was, look, they're not going to get religion all of a sudden and turn around and start acting like responsible actors. I don't see that happening. They're just going to keep trying to kick this can down the road. So where is that path, and what do you think, if any? I mean, is there a policy response to when this scenario starts playing out? What is the role?
Well, the first thing we're going to see is so this year we have $750 billion of corporate debt. So investment grade, loans, and high yield, $750 billion coming due. And over in Italy, for example, Italy has $850 billion coming due in the next 3 years. So we have a lot of really, you know, poor quality companies, a lot of near-term debt maturities in not just on the corporate side. In total corporate debt in the United States is three times what it was just over a decade ago.
Wow.
And we have a major maturity wall coming at us. So it won't take much. I mean, the central banks are going to have to shift to being very accommodative to prevent a major default push. But once again, an accommodative means cutting rates. But the problem is, it gets back to that whole early payment default thing. If the Fed goes really dovish one more time and starts to cut rates and allows for more easy borrowing, you're just going to get to a point where they've lent the money to the worst quality companies. At some point, you just reach, when we're very close, you just reach a point where defaults just happen because the cash flow of the companies just can't support the debt profile.
Yeah, well, and again, I don't mean to pick on Tesla. I may have heard this from you, but Tesla, and I looked into it and I verified it, but so if you didn't say it, I know that it's true, but I think Tesla is the first company that's ever passed something like a $35 billion market cap and had debt trading in junk levels. Was that your quote? Did I pick that up from you?
Yes. It was 52 billion of equity market cap with a junk bond. I mean, it's just crazy. Like, think about it. Sit back and think. That doesn't make any sense, because junk bonds, like in my entire career going over 35 years, a junk bond is issued to a company that doesn't have that much equity. Because if you have lots of equity, you shouldn't have to issue bonds at, say, close to 7-8%.
Right.
And when treasuries are yielding 2.5, and the Tesla bonds are 7-8%, it makes no sense. And it just tells you the credit markets, it's basically a war, right? It's an intellectual war. The credit markets are telling the equity, you guys are smoking in the dynamite shit. You're smoking in the dynamite shit. The credit markets are telling you that because you have a bond. Why is the Tesla high yield bond, why is that junk bond trading at close to 8% when you have a $50 billion market cap? Now, the equity people are telling you, you know, you guys are out to lunch. You don't understand the growth potential of this company. And, you know, it's and all the technology that Tesla has, their market share in the United States. You just don't understand. This is a new economy. You know, the upside is so outstanding that people are willing to pay $52 billion for the equity, even though they have, you know, a huge pile of debt.
Yeah. Yeah. The other thing that I think is interesting, and I don't know if you've picked up on this, so feel free to chime in, but the other thing I find interesting that I don't remember in 2007, 2008, and I could be wrong, but I have a pretty clear memory of that time just because of my own experience, but I've seen a unprecedented surge of, especially on the retail side, of investor optimism just in the last 4 months. An increasing amount of investors, even at our firm, worried about missing out on gains. To me, that is the siren song of, boy, we're getting long in the tooth here. And I look at the excesses, and everybody looks back at 08 and 09 as this big anomaly, right? It can't happen again. The words of Janet Yellen and her infinite wisdom. I look at it, and I, like you said, the credit markets are far more excessive. The equities are priced so much more richly than they were in 2007, 2008. And then the investor appetite at least from my perspective, especially on the retail side, is I haven't seen it. I in my career, 14 years doing this, I have not seen a level of retail investor bullishness just in the last 4 months. Have you seen that? And then does that also, again, it's anecdotal. It's not data. We can't point to it. But does that marry up with where we are in the economic cycle and your understanding of things?
Well, one thing we can't keep track carefully is, like, we look at capitulation moments. We have a model that measures capitulation. What I find fascinating is Warren Buffett in the fourth quarter, okay, he only put like $5 or $6 billion to work, which is this very small component of his cash.
Yeah.
So he has a record cash position, record. Okay, it's the biggest cash pile that he's ever had. And then in the fourth quarter, when stocks really, really, really went on sale, we're talking 20% down in the S&P, but the average stock was down close to 30. And Warren Buffett didn't deploy that huge, historic cash pile. That tells you something. It tells you a lot.
Yeah. Yeah. I know. And everybody's just whistling past the graveyard. You just got to keep buying up that equity and just keep doing it. Okay. So the other question I wanted to ask you is, and for those of you just joining us, we're joined by Larry McDonald here, author of A Colossal Failure of Common Sense, the inside story of Lehman. He was running the Lehman trade desk that amazingly made $2 billion of profit in 2007 while the company was bleeding out. The other thing I want to ask is get you into this dollar bull, dollar bear debate. And I haven't heard your thoughts on this. Maybe I just haven't dug deep enough. But will we be looking at a scenario where we're going to see massive dollar strength because of the upcoming issues? Or do you think, I guess I should say this, do you think the biggest risk to the economy at this point, we've identified the corporate debt and things like that, do you think we're looking at an era of inflation ahead of us as being the biggest danger, meaning a big loss in the value of the dollar? Or do you think we're looking at a very strong dollar being a hallmark of this next stage that we're coming up on?
Well, remember, so when I was growing up, the U.S. was 40% of global GDP, almost 50. So in like the 70s and 80s. Today, there's $62 trillion of GDP outside the United States, $62 trillion. Of economic activity, GDP, outside of the United States, and there's $18 trillion inside. So the U.S. is a very small component of the global economy. And on top of that, since the last, say, 12 years, there's an extra, you know, there's an extra $40 billion of debt in the world, maybe probably more like, I'm sorry, 40, 50 trillion, close to 50 trillion of debt. And out of that, there's $15 trillion of dollar-denominated debt. So those things combine to a really big problem for the dollar, because as we've seen in recent years, in 2015-16, the Fed said they were going to hike rates 12 times, the dollar ripped higher, and all of a sudden global default risk spiked, and the Fed had to stop. And that's because when the dollar moves higher, because of all the economic activity outside the United States and because of all that dollar-denominated debt, when the dollar moves higher, it really crushes the global economy. I call the dollar, you know, the global wrecking ball.
Right.
And you know, remember, the dollar is, in terms of global trade, in terms of currency, all that economic activity in the world, still like 65-70% of all currency reserve transactions are in the dollar. So when the dollar is strong, it just crushes that $62 trillion of GDP. And guess what happens? We saw this in the fourth quarter last year. That global economy really snuffs out the growth inside the United States. And the Fed promised us all last year, we're going to stay in our lanes. He said that 17 times,
yep.
Mr. Powell, the chairman. He said, we're going to stay in our lanes. In other words, we're going to hike rates. We don't care about the global economy. And the beast inside the market broke the Fed right over its knee. And that's because of the dollar. So net, 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 the dollar really has an invisible cap. If it were to really go much higher, once again, It crushes the global economy because of all the debt in dollars and because of all the economic activity that's traded in dollars. And therefore, then it comes back to the U.S. So there's, okay, so the dollar, say, 96.7 right now, maybe it goes to 98, 99. But so you have really, you know, two handles of upside. But you're looking at like 15, 20 handles of downside over the next 2-3 years.
Gotcha. Now, one of the
I would also just most importantly, I forgot to mention, it's very clear. We spend a lot of time taking our clients around the hill, around Washington. We'll take the hedge funds and the asset managers from around the world, from New York down around the hill. And it's just when you spend a lot of time in Washington, you really get a strong feeling that Trump is determined to find, that the Trump administration is determined to find whatever they can to get a weaker dollar. And President Trump just appointed two new Fed governors in the last week that are putting very dovish, dovish language in there, and they're kind of their assessment of where we are now. So, yeah, the Trump administration wants a weaker dollar, and heading toward the 2020 election, I think they're going to get it.
Okay, now what if? And I know that you, I appreciate the time you've spent with us, and we got to get you going. You're a busy guy, but one of the last things I want to ask you is if as this thing starts to unfold and we reach the end of this cycle and we start seeing the problems in the corporate debt market that you're talking about, what is to prevent the Fed from going full ECB mode and just starting to buy up corporates? And do you think that's a possibility?
Oh, that's definitely the next Fed, but it won't happen right away. It'll take a crisis. But for sure, right now, the Fed's balance sheet got up to $4.5 trillion. They took it down to $4 trillion so far, so they've taken $500 billion off the balance sheet. But that's still, very, very high, big balance sheet. And, the Fed promised us last year the balance sheet was going to go down to $2 trillion or $2.5 trillion. They said that like 27 times.
Yeah.
And now they're basically caving, and they're stopping the balance sheet reduction right around $4 trillion, maybe a little bit under, 3.8. So the next crisis, these central bankers, remember, they're so bought into their own policy, and this whole MMT, from the left, we have a number of left-wing candidates that are running for president far more than we've ever had in the history of the country. All these people support a Fed that is using the balance sheet to support, public debt profile, public issuance, really irresponsible fiscal spending, and using the Fed, the magic potion to enable really reckless spending.
Yeah, no, it's a strange new world, and it's one that you struggle to get your head around things. And one of the things is just a little side comment here. I'm going to keep asking you stuff. Like I said, I know you got to go, but a little add on to that. One of the things that keeps me rolling is keeps my mind constantly going and trying to figure this out is there's so many out there that go, hey, the Fed can't do this, the Fed can't do that. We're at this point of absurdity, and surely they can't go that far. I tend to look at things a little bit differently. I look at them as being so far off the track, so far away from normalcy, that what is to prevent them from ratcheting up even further? What is to prevent them? Like you were saying, yeah, that's the next step. I see that next step is almost a certainty. They're not going to, like I said, to start this discussion, they're not going to get religion. I don't see them changing things. And I think that they've created too many abnormalities and too many imbalances to stop doing it. What is going to happen that will take the keys out of their hand? Will it be a falling dollar? Will that be the thing that finally, takes the keys away from the drunk and makes them stop?
Well, yeah, eventually, the problem with like that, you have a good point there. Eventually, the market's going to overpower them. But the problem with that is the GDP in the United States is $18 trillion. the unfunded liabilities are anywhere from 110 trillion to 200 trillion, depending on who you're listening to. So there's tons and tons. And right now we're doing $1 trillion deficits a year. So it's a mathematically unsustainable debt profile. But guess what? If you look around the world at Italy, Japan, all you have to do is look at the other, even Canada, Canada and their irresponsible, reckless path that they're on. The problem is, if you're a billionaire and you have to put $1 billion somewhere, where on earth are you going to put it?
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, let's just say you wanted to put it in Switzerland or wanted to put it in Norway, right? You can't just put $10 billion in. There's not enough debt in these countries for you to buy, right? And there's not enough, very difficult to put that much money in oil or, gold. So, you can try to, gold pretty liquid. But at the end of the day, what's happening is so much wealth's been created that these billionaires around the world are forced to own treasuries because we're the tallest short man in the room.
Yeah. Okay, so we got to wrap it up here. Like I said, I know you got to get going, but as a parting shot, what would be your advice from a guy that's been on all sides of it, the buy side, the sell side, running the trade desk, doing the whole thing, now running a research firm, global macro research firm. It's got a ton of institutional clients. What would be your piece of advice to the layman, the retail investor out there who's all bulled up, has watched this thing go to the moon for 10 years, he's listening to the market cheerleaders, the Cramers of the world. What would be your advice to the retail investor about where he should be now and what he should be doing over the next couple of years?
Well, one of the things that we've been talking to our bear traps clients about around the world is looking around at the markets that are cheaper than the United States. What we do is we measure capitulation. We look for cheapness. We look for, value around the world. And for retail investors, you can buy emerging markets, some of them like Brazil, but you wouldn't want to concentrate, all your money in Brazil.
Right.
But a basket of emerging market equities that would give you a much better risk reward. So emerging market equities are trading at 13 times earnings, and the S&P is trading at 17 times.
Yeah.
So, that's one thing to look at. The other is in terms of bonds, you can always focus on, the short end of the curve or even CDs today. I mean, you've got a very high yield in T-bills.
Yeah.
So cash is paying a decent return, but finally.
And
then there are other sectors. The energy stocks have been decimated because of a number of reasons. I mean, right now the percentage of it, and don't forget consumer staples as well. So the percentage of the S&P that's in consumer staples, and remember consumer staples and the two groups that we're looking at, consumer staples and energy. Staples used to be 12% of the S&P 500 in, like, say, 2010, 11. Now they got down to like 6-7%.
Wow.
So what we do is we measure sectors within the S&P, big sectors, and we look for, you can tell when they're out of favor when they are a very small percentage of the S&P. If, for example, the financials in like 2006-07 were upwards of close to 20% of the S&P was in financials. And by 2009-10, they were down to 5 or 6%. And that was the best time to buy them, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So you want to look at energy down here. I mean, it's the percentage of the S&P that's in energy 10 years ago was upwards of 20%. Now, in the last 3-4 months, you've had, because of the view on electric vehicles and things like that, you're looking at energy as a very low component, like 6-7% of the S&P. And then there are emerging technologies like electric vehicles. So if you have a basket of investments that have energy, traditional oil and gas, oil companies, natural gas companies, and then own as well a basket of companies that have exposure to electric vehicles. Remember, China is selling last year 1 million electric vehicles, and that's up from 400,000 3 years ago. So China has a billion people, and they only think about this, a billion people, and they only sold 1 million electric vehicles. So you're talking about, you know, say 5-10 years from now, 10 to 20 million electric vehicle sales a year in China.
Wow!
And so there are companies and portfolios of companies that will benefit from these, you know, large growth sectors in the world, and that's where to really start to look and put the money.
So it's fair to say your outlook is not to short vol and be long tech stocks.
No, the semiconductors are a screaming sell here. The FANGs are just death. And the FANGs, you don't want to own a FANG stock. It's Facebook, Apple, Amazon, Netflix. There's just too. Remember, this. The other thing we haven't discussed, and just in closing, that one thing that investors have to understand is that, you know, passive investment strategies, which is just index funds,
yeah,
you know, have taken in $1 trillion in the last, you know, 2, 3, 4 years. And that money, when it goes into the index, it has to own the, you know, there's, so if $1 trillion goes into an index fund over like 2-3 years, that's like $200 billion that has to go into the FANGs. It has to go in. There's no portfolio manager that's saying, oh, I want to buy this stock or that stock. It has to go in. That's $200 billion. So every month there's another, like, you know, $5 to $10 billion that's going into these FANGs. That is just, there's no choice. It has to go. And so that's why you have these valuations that are just so absurd.
Yeah. Well, I can't appreciate you coming on enough. Fascinating conversation. And for those of you that want to follow Larry, and I would strongly advise it, you can get him at @ConvertBond, ConvertBond, on Twitter. You can go to the BearTrapsReport.com. That's his website. Phenomenal source of research. Like I said, we are becoming a client. And Larry, thank you so much for joining us. And hopefully it wasn't too painful, and we'll be able to get you back on at some point when these things begin to unfold a little bit more.
No, Zach, thanks for having me. And you know, I really appreciate the people out in the West Coast, and you guys are up in the upper Northwest, and it's a really wonderful part of the country. And every time I'm up there, I just notice, you know, being from New York and living in Manhattan, I really appreciate the people up in the great upper Northwest.
Well, thank you. And if you're ever in town, I'll buy you dinner and a drink. So let me know.
Okay.
All right, Larry.
Thank you,
thank you so much. Thank you for joining us. We got to run. But thanks for listening to the show. We'll be back next week. As always, you're listening to Know Your Risk Radio on AM 770 KTTH.